Hi, everyone. Hi, everyone. Hey, you're all awake. Last session, right? So, all in the right room? Active Directory? Yes? Fantastic. Hi, my name's Craig. Was anyone at my sessions yesterday? MBAM, UEV? Maybe half, maybe a third? Okay, cool. I look a little different to yesterday. My wife is none too happy with it. Today is the 1st of Movember. So I've been shaving up 3 weeks and then took it all off this morning. She was quite grumpy at me. But I think it's cool. So yeah, go and sign up. It's support of a good cause, right? It's to try and get us lot to go to the doctor a little bit more often, a little bit earlier, so that we can avoid cancer and things like that. For those of you guys that don't know me, my name is Craig. I am a Premier Field Engineer, which means that I work at Microsoft and I come and visit Premier support customers. Anybody here have a Premier support agreement in their organization that they know of? Maybe about half. Okay, the rest of you guys who maybe don't even know if you have it or not, the idea is that you pay a little bit extra and you get someone on site, an account manager or a service delivery manager, we're calling them now, a guy that will make sure that you're using as much of your support dollars that you're going to spend with Microsoft as best as you can to get as few incidents, as few issues in your environment, to try and make you a little bit more healthy. So that coordinator person will try and fan out your issues to maybe get you phone support with people who have all the way up to developer access so they can go and access the code, or they can send it off to a person who might need to go on site to try and fix a problem. And that's where we come in. We are 17 people in Denmark, PFEs, Premier Field Engineers. I think the last time I did this talk a year ago, we were 12. The time before that, we were 6. We're growing quite quickly. We do a few different things. We do your CritSits, your Severity A problems, right, where nobody can work, and you'll pay whatever it takes to get someone to come in and fix it. That's quite a terrifying part of our job to do. From that, we learn a lot of things about what makes your products work and what you shouldn't be doing, and then we take all of that knowledge and we build health check tools ourselves, where we'll come along and check your environment before the issues happen, and then we'll run all of our classes, our workshops as well. We'll try and teach you, and then sometimes we get to do cool stuff like this. But today we're not going to be doing any of that stuff. We're just going to tell you about features, right? So it's not necessarily about best practices and how to operate stuff. It's just a feature overview. Has anyone been to Tech Ed, the last session over in the summer, either in, I think it was Florida or Amsterdam? Yeah? Did anyone see a talk that was similar to this by a guy called Dean Wells, who comes from the product group in Active Directory? None? Good. Excellent. If there were any hands going up, I'd say you're probably not going to learn anything new here today, because this is pretty much his talk. But I rework it. He talks at about 1,000 words a minute, so I'm going to try and slow it down to make it a little bit more understandable for you. But really, what we're going to talk about is what's changed in AD. Okay, whether you want to implement it or not is up to you, just so long as you know that the features are out there. There is an awful lot to talk about. One of the things that we do as PFEs is we host these online calls. Every 2 weeks, we're going to do about an hour and a half, kind of a session like this on one small topic. Every one of these topics that I'm going to talk about now, just about, we're going to host a one-hour call, one-and-a-half-hour call through the next year. So this is going to be quite superficial over the top compared to what we're going to do as we go through the year. Okay, and those talks we're going to have bundled up on a website. You can go and review them. Only available to Premier Support customers. There's a lot of benefits to having Premier Support. Oops, did I forget the rest of my agenda there? I think I did. So what's changed in AD? And then the requirements to start using it as well. We're going to talk a lot about, and then not talk a lot about, functional levels, right? Domain functional level, forest functional levels, to get things working. And then there's a bit at the end, if we've got time, hopefully we do, to keep the geeks happy. It's going to be really hardcore. The impression that I've got from a few people talking in the last couple of days about the session so far is that they'd like it to go a little bit more deeper. This is the one that's really going to do that for you, okay? So if you're get a little bit scared when I sort of raise my hand and say we're at the For the Geek session. If it's gone too deep already, leave now, go and fill in your survey, give it great results, and everyone will be happy, okay? Because it's going to get quite scary at the end. Survey is really important, okay? I mentioned this to the people who were in my two previous sessions as well. The reason that the survey is so important is that not only do you win a prize, but they use those results to decide what kinds of session we're going to run next year, Okay? So, and I can guarantee you that those sessions that you found really dull and boring that were not the 300 ones that you wanted, right? Those ones that are aimed at the salespeople and the managers, those people fill in their surveys and they give great scores. That's the sessions that come back again next year. If you like what you hear today, you got to fill in the survey result because that's what makes it come back, okay? It's your responsibility. If you didn't like it this year, it's because you didn't do a good enough job with surveys last year. Good. Same page. And my boss sees the answers. So these are all the features that I want to talk about. There are more that are not up on here. I hope as you're reading through that, you're seeing stuff that you're thinking, I have no idea what that means, because you're about to find out. I'll go through them left to right, top row down as we go. Okay? The ones that I've highlighted in a darker blue, yes, shows up as a darker blue, good, are the ones we'll spend a little bit more time on because they are really important features. Okay? This whole slide deck, except for the animation with the mustaches, will be available for a download from the Campus Day site at the end. So you don't need to take photos of this stuff, okay? It'll be up there in a few days. So let's get going. First one that you saw up there, oh yes, here's our For the Geek session at the end there, right? These four things there. And we'll spend a little bit more time on RID exhaustion. Who knows what a RID is before we even get started on For the Geeks? Good, good, okay. DNT? Excellent. Okay, DC promo is gone. AD prep is gone. Silence. We took them off into a small room and shot them. Both of them side by side, never coming back. What we want to do instead of you guys going out and doing schema prep and being terrified about doing schema prep, what is it called? Forest prep, right? Instead of having to know that you need to do it, right? If you go into an R2 server and install the binaries for ADDS, you install the binaries, you have to know that you have to run DC promo. Nothing even prompts you to do it. Now, all of us in the room know that we have to do it, but for a new person, they don't, right? It's quite illogical. So when we do DC promo now, or the idea of creating a domain controller, we go into Server Manager, we install the role, and it pops up with a message saying you must do additional actions, and it guides you through it. Now, that wizard is actually fantastic. What it can do is remote that whole process. You can promote a bunch of remote machines from one console all at the same time. Anyone know that you could do that? Couple, yeah. So we have this idea of PowerShell being in behind it. We've taken away all of the GUIs that used to be there, and as soon as you go and add your first 2012 DC, it just takes care of everything for you. Now, to run AD prep for you, to run forest prep, you had to go to the schema master, right? You had to log in interactively there with credentials that are able to modify the schema, and then run your schema changes. Right? Is that really a good idea that we should log on interactively with the highest privilege account that we have in the network onto a domain controller? Wouldn't it be better if we could run that remotely and specify credentials for this one task? That's a much better way of doing it. But before, that's how we had to do it. So that's gone, right? So we just, as soon as we load up our first DC, it goes and figures out where our schema master is. What do we do after we run forest prep? What's the next switch that we put on? Close. Domain prep. Yes, we run domain prep per domain, right? Don't have to do that anymore. This will go through, talk to each domain, which DC did we have to log into interactively to be able to run domain prep previously? Wow. We had to go to the infrastructure master. Who knew, right? This tool will now go off and find the infrastructure master and do the domain prep on that one. Once we've run our schema master change, right? Yeah, people are leaving already. It's getting too scary. Good, good. Once we've run our schema master change, right, our prepared our forest, the schema master will also be told, now you please go off and replicate with the infrastructure masters in all of the domains to get the schema out there as quickly as we can. So we're really going to try and accelerate this stuff. What's the right way of extending a schema? What's the right way of extending a schema right now? It's to take your schema master offline, take another DC offline as well, plug the two together, make sure they use each other for DNS, otherwise they can't find each other, and then go and test that your schema works, your new schema extensions work. Has anyone actually done it that way? No? Before 2012, I would have smacked you if you said no. That is the way to do it. You test that the schema change does not break. But then how do you test that it doesn't break? What you have to do is get all of your applications to go and talk to it. But you just isolated it. So you have to go and isolate every one of your applications as well. That's not really going to work, is it? No. Schema changes don't break. Every schema in the world has to upgrade, and we have hundreds of millions of schema out there, and we upgrade all of them. MSIT, our schema, we upgrade every 3 months for 1 million computer accounts. It's not something to be afraid of, and this one happens automatically. When you would run DC promo, when you'd run AD prep with the domain prep switch, it would complain that, often it would complain that the infrastructure master can't be found. Well, I've just logged onto it interactively. I had to. That was the rule. How can it not be found anymore? What it's complaining about is the infrastructure master that's associated to the extra partitions, right? The DNS partitions, domain DNS zones and forest DNS zones. I would go and assign those ones a infrastructure master, even though it's not needed. It was the rules. It was because that particular partition is a child of a domain, and a domain must have an infrastructure master. So that child partition type must have an infrastructure master. But if I've gone and moved the original machine that created that partition, if I've moved it from my network, got rid of it, DC promoted it down, then it doesn't exist, and that attribute doesn't get updated, and I'd get this little prompt saying, you can't upgrade. And it was one of the most common causes of calls to our support center, right, was that we can't find that. All you'd have to do is just go and change the attribute, and life would go on. It didn't do anything at all. All gone, right? This will all be fixed as soon as you run your first DC promo. Happens automatically. We do all the prerequisite checking, so all those little attribute changes, all those things that we need to worry about. Can I contact the schema master? Am I a schema admin? Am I an enterprise admin? Am I a domain admin if I need to be for domain prep? It will check all of those things for us and then go ahead. It's integrated into Server Manager and remotable, so we can do all the DCs at the same time. Based on PowerShell, who understands PowerShell really well, loves it. My hand's just going up as an example. I'm not actually one of those people. I get minus help, right? Get minus help. That's all I do. But it's all in here. And I'll show you some cool stuff about PowerShell a little bit later on that will help people like me. When we would go and run our AD prep, the first option in 2008, the most common option that it wants us to do is build a whole new forest. No, that's not what we do. The most common thing that we do is go and add a new DC to an existing domain. That's the most common option. So we made that the default, right? Seems like an obvious change. Since we went off and killed that whole thing, we found that we had to go and put it back anyway. Why? Because people went looking for it because they wanted to do it one thing at a time. Extend the schema, domain prep. We still want to follow our existing change controls. That's the way we want to do it. So we had to go and put it back. Now, AD prep is still there as an executable, and all it does is call PowerShell, okay? Just so you don't get lost. And then we killed off the DC promo. Excuse me. The way that we promote a domain controller is also through PowerShell. It's based on Server Manager, right? So it's a new system. It is PowerShell-based, Server Manager-driven. It is remotable, so I can promote multiple at the same time. I can do simultaneous upgrades. It's not just one, two, three, four. They all come up at the same time. And it's the new promotion wizard. What do you think we would internally call that entire process? What's a good name? So they're right back. DC promo is still there. DCpromo.exe still comes up with an answer. And all it really says is, go and do it in the GUI because that's what it's for. Or run PowerShell, right? To have our first 2012 DC, our forest functional level must be 2003. Why? Because we need link value replication. These are the rights that we need, enterprise admin, schema admin, and we need domain admin everywhere else. Previously, when we were doing our upgrades, our DC promos, adding a new DC. Imagine I've got a DC in a domain that has a DIT, which is the AD database, a DIT of, say, 25 gigabytes, and I'm doing it over the WAN. How long should that take? Well, it depends. How fast is my WAN, right? How busy is my source DC? If I start promoting in every single OS previous to 2012, if I start promoting and a network error occurs or my source DC reboots, it could be going for days, this upgrade, so we may reboot. If that happens, I stop forever, and I never retry. There was no retry logic built into it. No Premier customer had ever said, this is a problem for us, can you please go and fix it? Premier customers get that, right? The ability to request design changes. No one had ever complained, but now we've fixed it. What it'll do is, if there's ever a blip, the smallest blip in the world, it will just retry, and it will retry, and it will retry infinitely. It will have to keep retrying infinitely because we don't know when the WAN's going to come up. 2 days of replication has already happened, for example. I might need 6 more days. Who's to say how long it's going to need? Only you guys get to decide that. So you can, it will keep retrying forever until you just go in and say cancel and give up, please. Anyone use install from media? This is the idea that you can take a backup of a database and then ship it to another machine, and then I've pretty much got enough of AD except for the most recent changes. Anyone use that idea? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 out of about, 200 people use install from media. Fantastic. Who doesn't use install from media? Yeah, about half, right. Quite a few people don't know whether they're using it or not. If you do install from media upgrade, the reason that you would do it is that I've got this gigantic DIP file, that example of the 25 gig DIP file. I've got one of those, and I need to get it out to a new DC, and I need it to be faster than I could possibly do it over the wire. Right? So maybe it's in a small branch office, and I can go and back it up and put it on media. I could do a robocopy, an X copy, or put it on a USB disk and give it to a shipping company. Right? I could do all of those things. Get it out there, and that will be faster than doing it over the wire. Okay? When we did that, when we bundled it up and put it onto the disk, what we would do is an offline defrag of the entire database before we put it onto this very expensive media like a USB key. Right? Really expensive. So we would do an offline defrag, which would take hours and hours and hours. And the reason that I'm doing this is to speed it up. Right? And I'm doing this task. Now, how many of you have ever done, on a fine, happy, perfectly well-running DC, ever done an offline defrag of AD? One hand. On purpose? Just to see what it would do? No one does this. It never happens in production. So why does it happen here? So we give you the option of turning off that defrag when you're doing your backup using NTDSU tool. Hoorah. Right? To speed things up a bit. Here we go. There's a nice big blue one. Virtualization safe technology. Anyone run DCs as VMs? Don't care if it's Hyper-V, ESX, whatever it is. Just about everyone. Who knows that you're not allowed to take snapshots of those VMs? Just about everyone. Who's done it anyway? Whose VM guys are doing it even though you've told them not to? Yeah. Now you can see where this problem's coming from. You could have a VM operator take a snapshot of your DC, think that he's doing the right thing, he's following the change control that said you're about to upgrade your schema. I'll take a quick backup. If anything goes wrong, we can roll it back. Takes the snapshot. All hell breaks loose because something went wrong. Maybe I've had a schema update go wrong. The schema propagated fine, but then everything failed on the rest of this network. I've got a little blog about it. If you want to know about that little story, it's one of the most fantastically interesting things I've ever done in my whole life. I'll share it with you afterwards. If you ever roll back a schema update, if you ever roll back a VM to a previous snapshot, you destroy AD, right? You destroy it. What we wanted to be able to do is have the VM be told by the hypervisor that something important to you has happened, right? Something important to you. What could be important? Well, like that rollback in time, right? That's really important to me. So we introduced this idea of, we're not there yet. We're still talking about how it works. Okay, so I've got a logical clock, right? A DC has like a logical clock. It's not a clock tick going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What it is every time I make a write to my database, I increment a number. It's called a USN, update sequence number, right? I just go and add one for every single write that I make to my own database. At update number 4, keep it nice and small, simple numbers. Update number 4, somebody takes a snapshot of the VM. Update number 5, a DC comes along and takes a replication of me. He says, look, the last time I knew about you, you were at update 1. Give me all of your changes from 1 through to wherever you are now. He goes, okay, that's 5. Gives me all of his updates, right? I know where you're at up to 5. I go and make updates 6 and 7, 2 more writes. Then somebody rolls me back to point number 4. And I've got no idea that it happened. Right? I then go and make different changes. 5, 6, 7, 8 are not the same changes in 5, 6, and 7 from before. Same DC comes back to me and says, I know all about all the updates up to number 5. Don't give me anything older than 5, but give me anything newer. Okay then, 6, 7, 8, and 9. What's happened? I've got different objects that represent 5, 6, and 7 on my first DC as I have from my other DC. How do I ever resolve that conflict? I will never find out. That's called a USN bubble, right? That's the impact of rolling back in time. This gets really bad if those changes, those rights, were creating security principles, because now I've got two users that are completely different from each other, but with the exact same SID, potentially. If I was also a schema master or any FSMA role owner at point 4, and then it was transferred away from me at point 7, and then I go back again, I still think I have it, but somebody else has it now too. I'll never know. Now we've got two FSMAs on the network, and all it takes is right-click, rollback schema, a rollback snapshot, and I've ruined AD. Anyone have this happen? USN bubbles? USN rollbacks? Lingering objects, you might see them as well. Yeah, a couple of people. This is a massive deal for us in support. These aren't small cases. These take hours and hours and days to fix. So the idea is that our hypervisor tells us this is your identifier. It's really a GUID, and it's just effectively a random number. AD remembers it, puts it into its database, says this is the number that I apparently am. The BIOS has told me this is my number. Now, Hyper-V 2012 tells me the number. ESX now, with the latest service pack, will tell me the number. Citrix and the others are still working on, hopefully, putting it into their platforms. But it's in my BIOS, and every single time that AD does a write to its database, it goes down to the BIOS and asks it, is the number still the same? If it is, fine, keep going. If the number has changed to any other number than the one that I knew previously, if the number has changed, then something terrible has happened, and I have to act on that. So here's a quick view over the problem. Time number one, we create a snapshot. Our USN number was 100. Our identifier, which identifies the database, right? Two databases replicate with each other. The OS is just there for TCP/IP. Okay? So two databases replicate with each other. And at the moment, my database has identifier A. I also have a RID pool, a pool of security identifiers that I can issue because I went to the RID master and I pulled them down. 500 of those. I create 100 users. So I have 100 rights. Effectively, I have way more than that because I need to change all the attributes. Nonetheless, I have incremented my number to 200, kept the same identifier, my RID pool got smaller, down to 600, and I went and replicated that over to DC number 2. DC 2 says, aha, DC 1 bracket A, which means identifier A hosted on DC 1, I know all about the changes up to number 200. Fantastic. Time 3, I go back to time 1. And I think it's USN 100 again. My RID pool rolls back as well. 150 users get added to me. Different users. Right? My RID pool goes smaller again. And I go and replicate the last 50 changes. The last 50, because he knew up to 200. Now I'm up to 250, so he pulls on only the last 50. And I've got 100 other users in there. I've got two copies. Two different sets of 100 users with the exact same SID on the network. And neither DC detects that this is a problem. Yes. So, how do we fix that? I have this idea of a saved VM ID, generation ID. So, right, so the DIT knows about this number, keeps it in RAM. It's incredibly fast. When they went to go and implement this technology, I said it's every write has to go and query the BIOS. It's actually faster now than what it was to do a write, because when they were trying to figure out how are we going to stop this from slowing things down, they found other performance problems and fixed them at the same time. And the actual VM generation ID is G1. That's what the BIOS is telling me that I have right now. 100 users added. Time 3 snapshot is applied, and then my VM GID gets changed, right? The hypervisor tells me something significant has happened. So what does my OS do? He goes and generates ID equals B. He says, my database is a different database. I take all of those RIDs that were in my pool, and I release them. I can't trust them anymore. I don't be a FSMO anymore. If I was a FSMO, or I think that I am, I'd stop being a FSMO also. I'll do one replication with another partner just to see, has anything happened while I've been away? And because I've got a new identifier, DC2 says, well, I've got two different sets of up-to-dateness vectors according to DC1's identity A or identity B. And they're two completely sets of different sets of information. They will replicate back to me because I've got a different ID. It's like doing a restore, an automated restore, a restore that you didn't even have to touch. It just does it automatically.
Sorry?
No, I'm sorry.
How will the DCs know how much to replicate?
How do the DCs know how much to replicate? Well, I've gone back to a point in time where I think I'm up to update number 100, but that this is my identity. So I don't know anything about about identity A. I don't know what updates have been created on A. Right? That's an old identifier. So I'll just go out and ask any partner, oh, you've been replicating with a guy called A. What did he create? He gives me a bunch of objects. Oh, okay, yeah, I know all about these guys, but these other ones I haven't heard about, and I'll pull down those ones. DC cloning, another important one. So, going to create new domain controllers. Want to do this faster. Has anyone set up a lab with maybe six DCs and it takes a real long time to go and replicate them? Anyone done a full forest restore? Foreign ministry? We did a test with them. We do this service where we go onto customer sites and we take their existing AD backups and we do a restore with them on isolated virtual hardware just to see if it will work. Every time we do it, it fails. Not a single person in here could restore their AD. I guarantee it. Terrifying, right? It's never worked for us. We have this massive catalog of real-life issues that every time one of our engineers anywhere in the world does this, they come back and write into it and say, oh my God, these guys have a password filter. It means that I couldn't change the trust password between any of my DCs. I had to get rid of this DLL filter that's sitting inside there just so that I can go and get the trusts working again in my forest. There's all kinds of little issues that prop up every time you do this. But once you've done it, a full forest recovery, you go and get one DC per domain. And then what? I was pointing out the foreign ministry, they have a great network with a DC in every single country of the world. How do they get all of those working again? They have to DC promo them down and back up again. Eek. And they're not in nice places of the world either, right? They're in some hot spots too. So they get bad WAN connections. So this idea is that we can go and take one DC and clone it. One DC is a VM, right? The first DC. We take a VM, we clone it, and we recreate it as a new DC. Well, how the heck does that happen? Same idea as the last idea. When you clone it, you create a brand new VM. What is its VM generation ID going to be? Something completely different. But you're giving this new machine, it's just a copy of the VHD file, putting it into a new VM, turning it on. As he turns on, he says, oh, I've got a different VM ID. Is that because I've rolled back in time? What the heck's going on? When he does this thought of, have I gone back in time, he goes to his NTDS folder, where the database is, and looks for a file that's called dcclonesettings.xml. If he finds that file, he goes, aha, it's not that I've gone back in time, it's that the guy's copied me on purpose. What's in that file? Inside that file, you'll find your new name, your new IP address, your new subnet mask, your new default gateway, your allowed application. That's a different file for allowed applications. What else will you get? That should be enough. We'll call that enough, right? Just what is your new name? What are your new IP addresses for IP4 and IP6? Once I've got that information, I just reboot, apply those settings with my new name and new ID, and I think I'm a different machine. But I've got to do other... If I'm taking... This is AD says I'm a different machine. I've got a new identifier, right? IDB. Sorry. I've got a new identifier. I'm going to start using that. So I'll do the same idea, and I'll pull in... new information that I haven't found out about that have been changes since I was last cloned. I'll pull in that information, but I also need to go and tell every single other application installed on me that we are a clone. Now, when you copy a running machine and turn it into a different machine, you run sysprep, right? Same exact thing happens. We go and run sysprep and reboot the machine. so that we can go and tell our running applications this is really important. Now, if I jump in here, I think I can show you these files real quick. There's some sample files that come on every DC now. System 32. And sample. There's the first one. So this is an example saying, here's your new computer name. Here's the AD site that you're in. That was the other setting I was looking for. DNS information, brilliant. What else do I need? Let's find other files that were around there. When I'm going to do my sysprep, I have to say a list of services that are allowed to just keep running. Let's think of services that should not keep running. Let's think of a service that cannot be sysprepped. Can DNS be sysprepped? Is there anything about the DNS service that can't just work on another machine? No, that's fine. We can just sysprep DNS and it's fine. How about certificate services? Ouch, no, don't do that, right? It's got all the private keys. We don't want to duplicate that guy. So there's certain things that will work and certain things that don't work. Here's a list of things that do work. And here's a list of DLLs that need to be run so that we can sysprep certain modules within an operating system. So this is what we've tested and works. What you've got on your running DCs will be something different. Right, so you'll have backup agents, antivirus agents, SCCM-ish applications that you need to go and check to see do these actually work. If you are sure that they work, you go and add them in as an entry like that. Say, I've tested it and it works. If it doesn't work, don't do it. Or remember to uninstall that application and reinstall it. Okay. So it'll do that part during the sysprep part. What else have we got here? Nothing interesting in there. Okay, so this is how the logic goes within a DC. It's a little bit more to it because it's got to make that decision of have I been rolled back in time or not, but on we go. NTDS, the service starts, get the gen ID from the BIOS. If it's different from what I have in the DIT, reset my invocation ID. That's my identifier that identifies the database, right? And throw away my RID pool again. Right? I can't trust my RID pool anymore because it could be that somebody else is issuing those same exact numbers. I'll just go get a new set of numbers. Do I have that file available? If it's not there, then I've probably gone back in time. I run this fixed clone. It's not actually fixed clone, but that's the idea of it. Read that file that's in that NTDS folder. Change my network settings according to that file, right? My IP address. Find the PDC. Why do I need to find the PDC? I've got one over there. Yes? 2012 PDC? Because I'm about to run a command against it that says, do something cool with this computer account. I came from a computer account, but I'm not that computer account. I want to be my own guy. So please go off and make sure that whoever I was is allowed to do this, right? Is this computer account that I've been cloned from, is that in a group called clonable domain controllers? If it's in that group, then this is allowed. This prevents the hypervisor administrator from being able to mess around with this stuff. Okay, so you, the enterprise admin, have to go and put these DCs into that group. If you are in that group, go and create a brand new computer object that represents this new guy. Give him all of the settings that he needs. Put it in the right place. Right? NTDS settings, that's the object that identifies me as a domain controller. Generate a brand new machine account and a password, and then tell me what the password is. Promote it. Clean up, so do sysprep effectively. Go through that long list of allowed services and applications. Reboot. I am now a DC. Take seconds, so long as your PDC emulator is 2012. But my forest functional level didn't need to be 2012. Remember at the start I said we're going to talk a lot about functional levels, but not at the same time? That was a massive feature where we didn't have to do anything with functional levels. We just needed one specific machine to be upgraded, and then everything will just work. That's pretty cool. Anything interesting in here? Yeah, there's multiple locations where it's going to look for that file, right? The directory containing ntds.dit is the preferred location, so it'll go there first. So that's where I really want you guys to go and save it. You could put it onto a USB key so that if you've got a stack of machines that are blades, you could just walk in with a USB key and put it in there. And it works with all of the common services that you find on a DC, like DNS, like FRS, DFSR. Okay? But not certificate services, obviously. Next feature, offline domain join. Offline domain join. What does that mean? That means you can buy a machine from Bilka or whoever else your retailer is. Take it back home, go to a website that you guys have set up, type in your domain credentials, and get back a blob, a big file, an ODJ, OPDJ file, off-premise domain join file. I get that file down, and inside of it is my computer account, my computer account's password, all of my group policies that I'm going to need, and all of the certificates that I would have enrolled in inside one big blob file. I take that file and put it onto my nice new Windows 8 machine that I bought from a retailer. I reboot, and I am a member of the domain. I have applied my group policies. I have a certificate. I have the group policies that tell me you are a direct access client. And as I turn on, I make a direct access connection back to work, and without ever having talked to a DC, I'm on the network. I'm on the network. And I'm talking to SECM servers, and I'm pulling down my updates, and you're talking to Exchange, and your domain credentials just worked. Fantastic, isn't it? So what else had to happen inside there? We had this blob before, right? We had offline domain join before. What we've done is we've added Kerberos proxy in the front there as well, so that when I come and authenticate to that direct access server, I don't present NTLM credentials, I present a Kerberos ticket. And he says, well, ordinarily you'd have to give that to a domain controller. You have to get that from a domain controller, and I'd have to go off and use that ticket that you've given me, but you can't contact the domain controller. So you give me your credentials, I'll act as a proxy for you, and I'll go back to the DC and verify that you've given me the right credentials. So that's really the bit that AD went and added. But that's how we're intending it to work. You will offer up a public available website that users can go to, type in their credentials, that will fire off a process that creates the blob on their behalf. Remember, every single user is allowed to have 10 computer accounts, whether they're authorized to or not, in your network by default. AD-based activation, KMS. KMS typically runs as an RPC service. What is it, 1688 is the port number that you target. Users will be configured either by group policy to go and find, not users, computers will be configured by group policies to find their KMS server. Okay? If they aren't configured by group policies, then they'll use their default domain name and then just append some stuff at the start there to try and find the right host name, connect to it. Without any authorization, they will activate against that server, consume a license. The other guy will record none of it, of this action. He'll put in an event log only. There's no database. And I'll have a license for 180 days by default. Right? That's how it works at the moment. And then you'd have to go and install new keys. As we release new operating systems, you'd have to install new keys for new versions of Office. So what we did is not really an AD feature. All we have is a bunch of objects in AD. You go and talk to one domain controller and you say, here's a license file. Go and create an object based on that. That license file gets activated over the internet just as a KMS server is now. And we go and create a bunch of objects in AD. Those objects replicate around to all of the domain controllers, including our ODCs. And we can activate Windows 8 and 2012 clients automatically. As soon as they domain join, they're activated. Right now, it only works for Windows, but Office 2013 should have this feature as well. You still need to have a KMS server for your Windows 7 clients, 2008 R2 clients, right? This is only going to work for Windows 8 clients. And because I'm talking to AD, I have to authenticate myself to AD, right? Before there was no authentication at all. And we just trusted that you guys, please, 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 would not put this onto the internet, your KMS server, right? If you did a couple times, you'd get an audit, which is not very fun. Yeah. What else is in there? So we're only using LDAP, so there's no requirement to open up RPC ports for this. That's 1688 and then a negotiated to a high port stuff does not happen anymore, and it even works on RODCs. And Windows 8 clients will prefer this as well over the existing KMS server. So they'll try this. Do the objects exist in AD? For this to work, I need at least one 2012 machine that can go and create the objects. But my DCs They just need to be able to replicate the object, so they need to have the schema extended. So they could be 2003 DCs. They just need the schema. So no functional level requirements again. So setup requires an R2 or a 2012 machine, just to go and create the objects one time only. All right? Group managed service accounts. Who'd heard of managed service accounts before? Who'd implemented managed service accounts before? Two. Wow. It's two more than I've ever seen. Managed service accounts in general are the idea that we can go and create a special kind of a user in AD, and we go and associate one particular computer on the network with that service account. And then the password for that computer, for that service account, will be updated using the same logic as is in a computer account. Right? So every 30 days, it will go and have a password that's about 140 characters long of binary noise. And I'll keep changing it and keep changing it. And you as the administrator never need to know what it is, because this guy's going to keep it updated. And the big limitation was, only one computer account can know that password. Well, what if this service account is maybe a backup account that needs to be across all of my servers? Across all 1,000 of them. Well, the workaround there is you go and create 1,000 managed service accounts. We're not really getting anywhere by doing that. Okay, so group managed service accounts come along. That looks more like it. The idea here is that we create a user account in AD called a GMSA, SMA, MSA, managed service account, GMSA. Create a user account in there. We assign it a password, so the first computer that comes along will assign it a password, and it gets stored in there. I will tell that account, here is a list of SIDs that are allowed to go and ask you what your password is, right? And that will be a bunch of computers, like those 1,000 servers. They're all allowed to go and ask what your password is, and they're all allowed to change it as well, right? So as soon as I go and change it, the others will start getting logon failures, and what do they do? Well, they're all 2008 or Windows 8 or 2012 machines, so they'll go, logon failure, right, must be a new password, go up and get it. These machines will go and find a 2012 machine as a DC to find out what their new password needs to be. They can't go and ask an R2 machine because he doesn't know this question, right? If you ask an R2 machine, what's my new password, he's going to go, no. You tell me what your password is. That's how authentication works, buddy. Right, so we built in extra logic into the 2012 DCs. Now, how do I find a 2012 DC? NL test. Let's see. Let's just do question mark here. NL test will go and get me list of domain controllers, sites that I'm in, things like that. I've got DS get DC. So talk to the directory service and get me a domain controller for some particular domain. When you do it, can you bring back all of the guys who are directory services version 8? Sounds a bit weird, version 8. That just means Windows 8. It's actually version 5. Let's go off and do that one then. DS get DC. I think we're called campus days. DS underscore 8. And I get back a particular DC that happens to have a flag next to it of DC8. What did I do there? Did I go and talk to every single domain controller in my domain? Hundreds of them? Thousands of them, potentially? Did I talk to all of them? No. That wouldn't make any sense at all. What I did is I went to the configuration partition and did a query of indexed attributes underneath my sites. I talked to all of these objects, all the NTDS settings objects, and said, where the value of MSDS behavior version is 5 or greater, and bring me back a list. I don't need a full list, I just need one that's close to me. So sort them by sites. So that call went and figured out that answer for me. And that's how I can find DCs that are at the right operating system for me to do my stuff. Group managed service accounts, if I'm going to go and pull down a new password, I need to talk to a 2012 DC that will understand that request. Right? The way I set up a group managed service account is all through PowerShell. Yep, exactly. So those 1,000 member servers, they all need to be 2012 servers or our Windows 8. That service account only works for services using the Service Control Manager. SC.exe will be the controller there. Works for IIS application pools and for scheduled tasks as well. Right? So we can set up scheduled tasks across all of our machines using one service account, and we never need to know what its password is ever again. So the question is, how do the machines prove who they are when they pull down that certificate, that password, and how does it not get intercepted along the way? So how does anything cross our network in a secure way? How does a machine boot up with a computer account password in it and prove that he really is a computer? He goes and talks Kerberos to him, right? And says, here's a blob of data. I've encrypted it with my password. If you know what my password is, then you really are a DC. He comes back and says, that blob was actually this blob of text. And he goes, yeah, that was the right answer. So now we have the ability to go and exchange data between each other in a secure way where we know that I'm talking to a DC because you know the password, and he's really talking to me because I knew the password as well. And once I've got that secure channel, if you want to call it that, then I can go and exchange any data that I want securely. What else do we need? Schema has to be updated because we're creating new objects in AD. We need at least one 2012 DC. If I can't contact it, these guys don't work. I need as many 2012 DCs as it takes for me to be resilient for this service. It's up to you to decide. We don't need to raise the forest functional level. We'll just hunt out the right guys. Got to use PowerShell to set it up. Connected accounts. Live ID, it used to be called. It's now called your Microsoft ID. This is not an AD feature. The idea with this is that you log in with your Hotmail account, effectively, right? We don't want that in an organization. We want them to log in with their domain credentials. And once they've done that, they can go and associate their live ID to that account. Right? So that's how we implement it. And it's really cool because it gets to roam your settings and things like that. I would highly recommend that you connect your live ID. You can go and switch this feature off as a group policy, right? Users can't do this on their Windows 8 machine. Great. Store is dead. We want them to be able to use their store when they go home to go and give their games to their kids and let them play on the machines. I'm sure there'll be other interesting features with store, but that's all I use it for right now. So I can go and associate my Microsoft ID, my live ID, with my network account. And I've done that with this particular account on here, right? And my Hotmail address is linked to my other account. Server SKUs don't do this. It's only for the workstation SKUs that do that. But don't go and switch it off because it will cause you guys more problems than it's worth. Okay? If you do it on a non-domain join machine, then you get to see the live ID when you go and choose, I don't know, permissions on a file. Okay? Cross-domain Kerberos constrained delegation. Kerberos constrained delegation. Another show of hands. Who's heard of Kerberos constrained delegation and implemented it? And yeah, ooh, okay. So the idea here is that a user goes to a front-end website, gets my Kerberos token that represents me, gives it to the front-end website. He says, well, I've got to go and talk to a database in the back end. I'm not going to tell you which database, but I'm going to do it on your behalf. So what I will do is I'll go off to the DC and say, I represent Billy. Can I have another ticket that works on a SQL server? Yeah, yeah, here you go. And so long as me, I'm allowed to go and talk to that particular SQL server, then I'll be able to get a ticket from the DC. So I go and set up the computer account that represents that web server to say you are allowed to delegate to that SQL server. Only works within the domain. So the front-end server has to be in the same domain as the back-end server. Wouldn't it be awesome if we could go and put our front-end servers, I don't know, on the intranet, the extranet, put the front-end servers there, or in the DMZ, and then have our back-end servers in SQL, and have them in two completely different domains. In fact, put them in two different forests. That's what we really want, isn't it? Because the boundary of security is around a forest blob. Forest blob in the DMZ, forest blob in the back-end servers. And now my back-end servers can say, hang on, I just don't want any compromised IIS server to be able to come back and talk to my data. I want it to be specific machines on the front end. So now the back end server can get to decide who talks to me. Before it was the front end computer account. Right? Now it's the back end server that gets to decide this stuff. That is cross-domain constrained delegation. Here's the details. So the client just needs to be XP. Brilliant. The client DC needs to be 2003. Brilliant. And then it gets a little bit more complicated. The front end server must be 2012. So that IIS server at the front must be 2012. And he must be able to talk to a 2012 DC. The back end server needs to be anything, 2003. But he needs to talk to a 2012 DC. And that schema needs to be updated on both of them, obviously. Right? And then we can go and set up these principles allowed to delegate to account variables. We set that on the back-end server's computer object that says these front-end accounts are allowed to come through to me. Okay. The next big topic, 25 minutes to go. Boy, oh boy. Dynamic access control. Who's heard of this one? A little bit. Do we have any sessions about this during campus days at all? No? Okay, so here's the idea. What do we got? We have, if we wanted to get the entire marketing department in our organization to be able to open up a file share, how do we do that today? We go and put them all into a group, assign the group read access. How do we assign, sorry?
AGDLP.
Users go into domain local groups that go into global groups that get rights and permissions. Fair enough. Yes. So we put them into a tiered set of groups where we define roles and we define permissions. Whatever. Put them into the groups. How do we define who goes into the group? Who becomes in the role? Who is the role of marketing? Well, me doing it, I'd probably go to AD, right, and go to that department tab and find everyone where marketing equals department equals marketing. I had to go and ask AD who should be in a group. Why didn't AD just tell me who was in that department already? I could claim to be, if I am a person in marketing and my department equals marketing, I can claim to be from the marketing department because my attribute has been set by an administrator. I could just use that. I don't need to be in a member of a group. I could just say, this is who I am. I am a marketing person. Or my address is this. Or my boss is this guy here. Right? Or my title includes the word manager somewhere in it. Right? So if I've got some privileged information that I want all of my managers in my entire organization to know about, I could define managers. So I go and get my my Kerberos token from the DC. It has all of my groups in, as usual. And if it's a 2012 DC, it can also have all of the claims about who I am. Now, the DC needs to know, well, what should I include in that ticket as a claim? Should it be the manager, the title of the person? Should it be the department? So it gets that from AD. We go and insert a list of attributes that we want to include in our tickets so the DCs know what to do. Only 2012 DCs can do this, remember. And they'll give me back a list of all of my groups and a list of my claims. I'll forward that onto a file share and say, well, this is who I am. I can't read it, but you can because you're the file server that I'm trying to log into. He'll open it up and see all my groups and go, brilliant, don't need those. Can, maybe, use those groups. But what I'm more interested in is these claims. You claim to be in the marketing department, and this came from a DC, therefore I trust it. I can combine my credentials, not just me as a user, but also my machine. Compound identity. I can combine the two and then give that to the end file server and say, look, I'm in the marketing department, and my machine's current location is in a branch office. So while I could be in a marketing department and get certain data, while I'm outside of headquarters, I'm not allowed to have access to that data while I'm in a non-HQ location. Right? So I combine my identity, and the file server has a set of rules. It says, hey, you need to be in a group. A group could be everyone, just to keep it easy. But your claims have to match this, and I have an and sequence. So you need to be in the marketing department, and you need to be on a machine that is managed, and that machine needs to be in a location that is not equal to branch. And the file that you're accessing needs to have a classification of high business data. If all of those things are correct, I'll give you the file. If any of them are wrong, don't match my rules, you don't get access to it. And now I don't need this long list of groups in my token. I just need the claims that prove who I am, and that's all. I think I've got some shots of that too. Compound. There we go. So this is also working on the auditing tab. This is why I brought it up. The interface looks exactly the same for setting permissions. I go and choose a security principle at the very top. That could be a group. I've chosen everyone to highlight the fact that we can bypass that whole thing altogether if we want. All right? And in my example, this is taken from my computer, right, and my network, an MSIT's network. You have to be a user who is an employee type that equals FTE, full-time employee. Right, so we have 50% of our workforce is full-time employees, and the other 50% are vendors that we hire from the outside. They don't get to see secret stuff that we talk about, like products that are coming up and source codes and bugs. They don't get to hear about that stuff. And so I need to be a full-time employee, and the resource that I'm trying to get to has to have a compliancy, which means, how would you say, a business impact level of, and I've chosen one object in there, and that item was maybe high business impact, right? So if you want to get access to high business impact files, you've got to be a full-time employee. I could go and choose device in there and say state equals managed, and it's an and. That really important word there is and. It could be an or, right? So I could go through all of this, or if you're the CEO, you get everything, right? You can build these up. And these are like gates. So the first gate is the share. When you walk through the share gate, you get to the NTFS permissions. Switched off, right? Everyone. Next gate is that bottom one there where I've got my conditions, my dynamic access control. So this is a two-part story where I need the DCs to be able to support it. I need the clients to request it, the DCs to support it, the member server to filter on it. But I also need my member servers to go and classify my data. So there's a file classification engine that's available for the file servers that can go through and look at every piece of data on your file server. And what's it going to look for? Well, here in Denmark, we'd probably look for six numbers, a minus sign, and four more numbers. CPR. If you find anything that has that string in it, it's a CPR number. That Word document has to be high business impact. We can't allow that data to leak, ever. Right? Anytime you put a CPR number into a piece of document, boom, high business impact. Maybe another one might include certain keywords in there as well. It might say things like payroll, things like that. We can automatically classify every single one of our documents, and now our file servers can go and enforce that. I'm focusing on file servers for a very good reason. No other system implements this yet. Hopefully SharePoint will, but it doesn't. Okay? But that's the idea. We and all these conditions together. This is a massive topic, right? Dynamic access control is not just one little thing that you can talk about in 6 minutes. It's a gigantic change in the way that we work. This idea of combining our claims about who we are into our access tokens. If I am coming from a down-level client like XP, and I talk to this member server, he'll say, you've given me no claims. I require claims, but you've given me none. I'll do something called, what's it called? S4U to self, which means I'll go and find out who you really are. You've told me who you are, but I'll find out who you are. So I'll go back to a DC on your behalf and then pull out your claims for you. So you gave me your Kerberos token. It was effectively empty, so I went and do it for you. Right? So we can still even support our down-level clients to do this. We need our machines to be able to authenticate to a 2012 DC. So we need enough of them. If there aren't any, I don't issue claims, so I can't get access to the data anymore. You can go and tick a group policy and apply it to the group to the domain controllers that says, damn it, every time you issue a Kerberos token, make sure the claims are in there. An R2 DC is not going to understand what that group policy means. He's not going to do it. So if you want that group policy to apply and work, you now have to raise your domain functional level. Okay, so that's the first time through all this talk that you actually need to do something. You don't have to. You just have to have enough 2012 DCs. But if you want to guarantee that every time I go into that, I get a claim, you've got to raise your domain functional level. I think I'm going to skip some of this one. There we go. Self S4U to self for down-level clients. We can include Kerberos claims inside our DFS tokens. Well, how were we doing it before? Anyone use DFS for anything? Not DFS, ADFS. Federation services. Right, only a couple. So this idea is that I will go to a website, and I've come from my domain. I'm talking to somebody else's domain in a completely different forest. No trust relationship whatsoever. I talk to this guy, and I say, can I get access? And he goes, well, you need to prove who you are. You need to go to this other guy who is in your forest, who I trust, another ADFS server. You give him your Kerberos token. He'll go off to the DC, find out if this is actually valid. He'll go and build up a token. He'll give it back to me. And that will prove that you are who you say you are. You'll do the heavy lifting of giving me the packet. But once you've got this from a guy that I trust, I will now assume that you are someone that I trust. That's how ADFS works. Now I can get access to some other website in some other forest. And I never needed to have credentials in that other forest. I didn't need a user account. Right? The problem with Kerberos, with all of this stuff and claims, is that if I go and present, as it is at the moment, if I go in R2, if I present myself, my Kerberos token, to an ADFS server, he will have to go and do an LDAP query back to AD and say, is this guy a member of marketing? Is department equals marketing? I would much rather have the ADFS goes and is aware of that first token that I presented that has my groups and my claims in there. So we went and revisioned ADFS to enable that. So that's called ADFS 2.1. That is the only change that you'll find in 2.1, and that it is now embedded into the CD when you install 2012. Compound ID must be switched on for the ADFS service account for this to work. That's where you enable it. Compound authentication. I shouldn't have gotten rid of that. But there it is there. All right, that group policy under Kerberos. ADFS 2.1, I think we're just going to skip this one as well because that's basically the same thing. Shipped inbox. Hurrah. Recycle bin. Has anyone used the AD recycle bin? This is the holy grail of upgrading all of our DCs. We've got a couple of hands. Come on. Only a couple of hands. This is the holy grail of upgrading our DCs to 2008 R2. This is why we do it. This is the big, cool feature. Once we've got all of our DCs through our entire forest here, we can go and raise our forest functional level, and we still don't have this. We have to purposefully go in after we've raised our forest functional level and enable this feature. How do we do that? PowerShell. I don't understand PowerShell, so I've never done it. I've never raised a domain functional level to 2R2 and then enabled the recycle bin. Not even in test. Not even as a muck around. I've never done it. So I bet you guys haven't done it either, right? It's so difficult to find. Now, we have this thing here called the Active Directory Admin Center. We had it before. It was very limited. Now it's a lot more functional. We have this idea of our domain down here and our dynamic access control stuff in here. So this will go and set up all those policies that we want for our DCs. If you're going to issue claims, make sure you include department. But we can do other cool stuff with our domain here. Really quickly, here's my little GUI. Go and search for an object so I can do stuff with it, or go and reset someone's password. The two big things that you do inside any of our AD tools. Click on the domain. Think, think, think. Look here. This window that I'm looking at here, that's the default window, right? Enable recycle bin. Remember, I've never done this before. Are you sure you want to? Once it's been enabled, we can't go back. Not even through restore. We have to go and DC promo down all of our DCs if we really want to get rid of this. Okay. Done. Not bad, hey? Well done, Craig. Okay, let's go and do one. Jump into users. And let me go and create a new user. Because we did something else that was cool here. So let's call them test a B, C. Test A, B, C. And I might want to join into a member of a group so that we can see that he retains his group memberships if he does after he's been deleted. Member of, how do I do that? Add. Let's go and find all the groups that I can be a member of. Backup operator, sounds nice. This is nice and simple, right? One domain. This was cross-domain. Things might get a little bit more scary. They don't, but it might do. What that means is that when I delete a user account, I have to go back to the other domain and say, you were a member of a group over here, but we deleted your account, so that link gets changed. If I do the restore in my first domain, I also have to go to the other domain with an LDIF file and go and modify that group account to put back the membership. RecycleBin just transparently hides all of that complexity. So I have my user, he's a member of a group. Where did he go? Test ABC. Delete. Okay, so how do I get him back? Let's go back to the domain. Where are we? Am I at the root of the domain? Yes. Thank you, sir. Deleted objects. Let's go look under this node for test ABC. What do I want to do with him? Restore him to where he was. Maybe where he was doesn't exist anymore. Maybe the whole OU that he was sitting in got removed. Or restore it to somewhere else. Let's put him in the computer's container. Done. Is he still a member of that group? Yes. I'd never done that before. How easy was that? Ah. So we have a GUI. What's the difference? What do you mean it doesn't go through the recycle bin? With shift. Delete the user with shift. Anyone here want to take a guess whether that's really going to delete it if you hold down shift? What are the votes for really delete? Or he's talking a load of rubbish? Yeah. Because when I delete something, I have to turn it into a tombstone that has to replicate around. When I enable recycle bin, all I do is I don't turn it into a tombstone. I leave all of its attributes as they were, and I keep them up to date, like the membership. Even if that backup operators group moves OUs, I still keep it intact. Everything's still fine. And then I will mark an attribute called isRecycled equals true, and it will sit there for 180 days. At that time, I'll mark it is deleted, and I'll delete out all of its attributes. I need to do this so that all of my domain controllers through the rest of the domain know that this guy is gone in the right way, because they could be offline. So there is no shift delete. Okay? Question? Works for every object. Every object. OUs, you name it. Everything. Any object you delete. Okay? Has done since R2. It's just we have a GUI. That's the only change, right? So we still need the R2 forest functional level. But to do the restore, we just need one admin center. We need one machine that's running that GUI. This thing here, that's all we need. And it could be an 8 machine. Well, AD does that itself, right? So that was the idea of, the question is, could you delete a deleted object? So no, what we do is we wait the 180 days. And then we turn it into a tombstone. We need to do this so that all of the domain controllers know where we're at. We can't just delete shit, delete stuff from one place and then late on the last day, everyone's giggling at swear words. No, we can't just delete stuff from one place. We need to replicate it around properly so we all know that it really has been deleted, including DCs that might have been offline for months and months and months.
Question?
Yes. So the question is, if I go and bring a deleted object back again, will there be a check to make sure that the name doesn't exist? So for user accounts, the thing that needs to be unique is the SAM account name, right? For all other users, any security principle, the SAM account name needs to be the same, needs to be unique in the domain. So when I go, if I created, while he was gone, if I created another user called test ABC, when I give him the same SAM account name, that will fail because it says the object and there isn't already an object with that name. For the distinguished name, well, distinguished names need to be unique, but the bit that makes a distinguished name unique is the common name, right? The first part of my name. But I'm now in a folder that's called deleted objects with a mangled name. When I go into deleted objects, I get this really horrible, weird name to make sure that this flat folder that is deleted objects, there's no hierarchy in there to make sure there's no duplicates. And when I get restored, if there already is a test ABC into that new place, he says, well, you can't move them in there because then they'll have the same name. So that restore to in a different location will cause me a problem. I'll just restore it somewhere else. But remember, all we did was add a GUI. This feature's been around for ages. Fine-grained password policies. This idea is that, anyone implemented fine-grained password policies? Couple, two, three? Give me a scenario why you would want to use it.
You want a scenario?
Yeah, why? Why would I do this?
We are hosting Exchange for some customers, and some customers want different policies than others.
Cool.
And we don't want to create a lot of domains.
Perfect, yeah. Hosted Exchange was the scenario there where we've got different customers using the same domain, but we don't want them to have the same password policy. That's a good one. Another one that we could use is service accounts must have an incredibly complicated password. Domain admins must have a password that is even more complicated. Agreed? Good. Kiosk users maybe want to have a really simple account. School children probably want to have a password policy that is really simple because they forget them. Things like that. So the idea here is we go and create a domain global group. We go and assign a policy to that domain global group with a preference order in case we accidentally assign multiple policies to it. And we say, for this policy, for this particular policy, this is your password policy. You've got to change your password every X days. It's got to be this long, complexity on, off, blah, blah. The way we did it before, this is an R2 feature as well, was to open up ANSI Edit, create a new object in the right location, remembering where this hidden location was, next through it, and each time I would next through it, it would prompt me for a new value, like how many bad passwords do they have to type before it locks out? How many bad passwords do they have to type inside a certain time window? How long should that time window be before I count that as being locked out? I have to know all these variables and weigh them all up in my head and keep them all right. Really complicated stuff. Doable, but really complicated. Now we have a GUI. Hurrah. And it's, again, inside this wizard here. So I go to my system and password settings container and, oops, add a new object. My clicker's not working. Right. New password settings. And now I get a GUI that looks like something that makes sense to me. Right. And then I go and assign this one to, who should it apply to? And I assign domain global groups in there. Cool. So we have a GUI. Hurrah. 3 minutes to go. Again, we just need the domain function level to be up and the GUI, and the particular GUI. It doesn't have to be on a 2012 machine. PowerShell command line viewer. As I do commands, I get a little window at the bottom. Exchange has had this for years. Every time you move a mailbox, there's a command that you can go and copy, paste, run again yourself. Now AD has the same thing in that admin center. Where is it? It's down the bottom. Windows PowerShell history. Enable AD optional feature. That's when I turned on the recycle bin. That's the PowerShell command that does it for me. And all the options that I need. Right click, copy. Hurrah. Where's my slides? Sure, question? Will there be a similar thing for Server Manager? No, this is a different GUI. So Server Manager is for some things, and this is for another. This, what we have is what we have. Good. How do I tell whether AD is replicating or not? What's the tool right now that I would use to find out if AD is replicating? RepAdmin. Fantastic. You get a prize, actually. I got some of these prizes. The RepAdmin guy show up his hand? Cool. Come and grab it at the end. I won't throw it because I'll hurt the people in front of you. Or the people way at the back. They're the ones in big trouble. Now we've got PowerShell commands that can do basically the same thing. Because that RepAdmin was really difficult to automate. The way that it would come out with its output strings would have these quotation marks around it, and you'd have to go and pipe it to something else to try and clean it up to make it do what you wanted it to do. So now it's all PowerShell. But there's a lot of commandlets in there about replication. We've got 1 minute and 35 seconds, guys. I don't think we're going to cover this one. Read exhaustion, I'll do it as fast as I possibly can. So the idea here, I'll skip about that bit about there, is that, hey, yeah, all that complicated stuff that makes it all sense,
ha,
not going to see it. A rid is the last part of your SID. It is 2 to the power of 30 long, which means 1 billion. In one domain, we can have 1 billion security principles. We never reuse the numbers. So if I go and create 500 million and delete them all, I can now create 500 million more, and then I'm done. Okay? I can issue them in batches of, say, 500 to a particular DC. And now he'll consume those 500 and use them, and as he runs out, he'll go get some more. I can turn that number up from being 500 all the way up to 1 billion. So the next time someone goes and makes a request, you are now the FISMO that issues security principles, because no one else can. As I start running out of these, maybe someone's turned the number up really high, maybe someone has gone and created a bunch of users. If you go and create a user, don't assign it a password, and then get a cancellation request that says, this password does not meet the complexity. You hit cancel, it consumed that RID. Same for computer joins as well. If a DC gets deleted, his NTDS settings object gets removed, and that removal happens and goes around all the DCs and then comes back to itself before it's finished demoting itself and goes, oh, I need to delete myself. So I better go and promote myself real quickly so that I can do the deletion work, and it goes back around. And each time I do that, I consume another RID pool, and it goes around and around and around in a circle, consuming RID pools again and again and again. There's a lot of ways that we can consume our RIDs, and as soon as you've run out of RIDs, there's a nice, trivial, easy way to go and fix the problem. Migrate everything to a new domain. And there's no warnings that it's about to happen. So what we did is we said, 2 to the power of 30, what's the 31st bit? What would happen if we started using that in our RIDs? That 31st bit means you are an account that has come from a Novell organization. No red t-shirts in this room, I don't think. No? Good. Never going to happen. So we now use the 31st bit inside our RIDs. So we've now got 2 billion possible numbers. As we hit 10% usage of our RID pool, we alert you in the directory services log. Every 10%. So we're going to get more and more and more frequent because it's going to get closer and closer and closer. Right? There'll be more and more logs, events. As we consume 90% of the total pool, what do? RIDmaster stops because no admin reads the event logs. Do we? No. We never read the event logs. So we just stop. That's what makes an admin do something. Something doesn't work. Right? So now I'll go and read the event logs. Oh my God, what's been going on? But it's okay, I've still got 10%. And in that event, it says, this is how you go and fix the problem. Because what we've done is we've just gone and switched an attribute in AD that says stop issuing RIDs. I just turn that back again and I can start issuing RIDs again. What else have we done? That circular problem of the deletion going around and around and around, that was a bug, so we just fixed that one too. As a computer account gets created, if it doesn't pass requirements, we don't actually consume that SID anymore. That would be about it. More logging, and we break things. Oh, and the magic number that we could go from 500 RIDs at a time per allocation all the way up to a billion, it's now hard fixed at 15,000. Okay, so we can't ever request more than 15,000. If you screw it up to a billion, you can. We'll just go and give you 15,000 each time. I think that is kind of about it. Oh, and that fix, all of those fixes for issuing the 31st bit, more logging, all of that has been added to R2. So there's the link to it. You just go and install it onto your DCs. A DC that is R2 will not issue the 31st bit, RIDs in that pool, until it's got that hotfix, but it will observe them. Right? You can have a RID that has that length, and it will be fine. Okay? I'm going to leave it to you guys to ask questions now, if there are any, because the red lights have been flashing for a while.
Assuming we have domain controllers that are all dedicated, and we are running an Exchange 2007 organization.
Exchange 2007?
Yeah.
Okay.
We are migrating to 365. But
okay.
Shouldn't we just upgrade our domain controllers anyway? I mean, do you see any problems here?
So the question is Exchange 2007 supported? Oh, tell you what, before everyone disappears, make sure you're filling your survey. Remember that point that I made at the start? We've got technical sessions here. We've got some fluffy sessions here. The ones that you want to keep coming back, you know what to do. All right. Thank you, guys. I hope you've had a really, really good campus day. So if there's any more questions, do just come up, I think, would be the best way to do it. But I'll keep answering your question. Yours was, is Exchange 2007 supported working against 2012 DCs? No. Until the Exchange team goes and tests it. Why would they go and do that? They might, but right now they haven't. They need to do proper extensive testing. Keep enough 2008 R2 DCs around, because they are supported, and then go and add 2012 DCs to enable the functionality. Maybe we don't have to raise the forest functional, domain functional levels anymore. Cool. Yes, yes, I can. Sorry about that. Survey. I got about halfway through these slides. Isn't that good? Oops. There we go. Take photos of that. Hope you guys had a really good campus days. See you next year.